this week's episode, we continue our founder origin stories as Sherry interviews Erica Douglas. Erica started and sold a web hosting company for $1 million by the time she was 26. She went on to raise funding and started a SaaS app called Whoosh Traffic. She's been a speaker at MicroConf Las Vegas, and she currently blogs at erica.biz. Her story shed some interesting light on what it's like to be a female in the startup space, and I hope you're as impacted by it as I was. Before we dive into the interview, I wanted to let you know that Sherry and I will both be speaking at MicroConf Europe in Barcelona this August. So if you're interested in hanging out with us in Barcelona, come to microconfeurope.com. By the time this episode goes live, tickets should be available. So let's dive into the interview. Welcome to the Zen Founder Podcast. I'm Rob, the founder.
And I'm Sherry, the clinical psychologist. And we've come together to help founders and their families stay sane while starting up.
Each week, we'll talk about different ways to work well, stay emotionally and physically healthy, and stay connected to the people that you care about.
What kind of kid were you?
It starts now.
But just like, what was your personality like when you were a kid? Were you shy? Were you?
Well, I always tell people I put the H in ADHD.
Really?
I was the hyperactive kid, but I'm also an introvert. So it's a really weird combination because when people meet me, especially when they met me as a kid, they assumed I was very extroverted because I was super hyper about everything.
You were moving a lot.
Yeah, I was running around. I would blurt out things. As an adult, I finally got actually diagnosed with ADHD, but I probably should have been diagnosed as a kid, for sure. I really struggled in school because of that. I ended up getting good grades, mostly because I was smart enough to fake it.
To figure it out, even if you weren't
sitting
still. Yeah,
I would never do the homework, but I was smart enough to understand what was going on, and I knew my test-taking skills, like always pick C, and so I just kind of used that to get ahead.
Always pick C. What was your family like?
So I'm adopted. I grew up in Indiana, and my mom was a school teacher, but she quit her job when my parents adopted me. My parents are a lot older than most parents. They adopted me when they were 38. So, and especially back in the 80s when I was a kid, that was unusual.
Probably most in parents, Indiana too.
Yeah, they're probably 15, 18 years older than most of the parents there. And now, as a 30-something myself, I understand what that must have been like for them. But back then, it was just really awkward because I basically had the oldest parents in school, other than one kid who was being raised by his grandfather, who was only a few years older than my parents. So it was kind of strange.
Did you always know that you were adopted?
Yep. My parents were really open about it. I'm very thankful for that. They gave me a book when I was a kid. I don't remember what it's called, but there's a picture book for younger kids that explains what adopted is, and they gave me that. And so it was great to know that from a young age. I don't think it ever had a really huge effect on my life. My parents were pretty cool, so.
You had good parents.
Yeah, the best that you can do. I mean, they had their quirks, but it's tough.
Is that the worst thing you say about your parents? That's pretty impressive. How did you make your way into technology? Like, when you were a child, were you interested in technology? Do you have lemonade stands in the corner?
Yeah, I like to tell, there's two stories of my childhood that really exemplify the fact that I was both into technology and an entrepreneur. So the first one about technology in particular was one weekend when my parents were gone. I rewired the entire television VCRs. We had a VHS VCR and a Betamax machine. Now I feel really
old. Child of the 80s. For the kids who don't know what that is, Google it.
For the kids who don't know what that is, Betamax was my dad's like biggest thing because the tapes were physically smaller and they were higher quality. Although you could record fewer minutes on them, which is why VHS won, because you could put longer films on VHS. So Betamax tapes would only run like an hour and a half, I think. So, but my dad had a library of Betamax.
So you rewired the whole setup?
Yeah.
Like with a screwdriver breaking into the compartments of the devices?
No,
way they were organized
together?
Just the
actual wires, because behind the TV, we had the wires running from the TV to the VCR and the Betamax. We had stuff running out to our antenna because we had an antenna. We had stuff running to other TVs in the house, and the wires were just all over the place. And of course, I had a Nintendo, being a child of the 80s, so that was also plugged in there. And it was just a complete mess. You go behind the TV and there was just this mess of all these wires going everywhere. So I actually rewired it and then diagrammed the entire thing on paper for my parents. And then when my parents came home, my mom freaked out and she was like, it's not going to work. And then everything worked except for one little piece. And I knew what was going on. So I rewired that too. And then I fixed everything and I found like an extra wire that didn't go anywhere. And I was really excited about all this. And then they had a wiring diagram for all of how everything connected on their TV.
It's a great problem to solve.
So these are the kind of things I did for fun as a kid.
How about entrepreneurship? Were there early money-making schemes that you were working on as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. My dad's an entrepreneur, too, of sorts. He runs a law firm. Still does. Actually, they're about ready to retire now. My parents are 70. So they're spinning up into retirement, and my dad is about ready to hand over the reins in his law firm to a young lawyer who just graduated from law school, and my mom's handing over her now title company to another lady who's going to run that, and they will hopefully retire in the next year or two. We'll see. But my dad always encouraged me to become an entrepreneur, and he was really specific about why. He said that women have a glass ceiling in the corporate world. Remember, this was in the 1980s and early 90s.
Because it's way different now.
Yeah, well, yes. Yeah, it's unfortunately not that
historical context.
Different.
Yeah, it's being a little sarcastic.
Yeah, but he said, you know, women have a huge glass ceiling in the corporate world. It seems like it's really hard for women to work their way up in the corporate world. So I would encourage you to become an entrepreneur and make your own destiny.
Do it your own way.
Yeah, we lived on a golf course in Indiana and people would hit golf balls into our yard all the time. So my dad and I would go around and pick up all the golf balls that people hit in our yard. And we'd go into the woods by our house and pick up golf balls. Actually, when I was little, I didn't understand that all forests did not contain golf balls.
That they weren't native to forested areas.
I just kind of got used to the fact that you would go into the woods and look for golf balls. That's kind of just what you did. So I would always go in and look for golf balls, and I thought it was weird that not all forests had them. So we'd go in and pick up all the golf balls, and I'd sell them for 25 cents out of egg cartons on the first tee of the golf course. The biggest problem for me was that I had to get up early. I was never one to get up early, ever. But I would get up early enough for golf tournaments, and by their second or third round, when they'd had enough beer, I would sell them a lot of golf balls. Some people would come by and buy whole cartons of golf balls for like $3. I'd make 15, 20 bucks on a good weekend. So.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. It was a fun early entrepreneurial experience. My dad made me go get permission from the owner of the golf course, whom he knew. So it was somebody that he was familiar with and friends with. But he,
so it was a legitimate business.
Yeah. So he ensured that I had followed all the rules in order to do that.
What did you study in school?
So I graduated high school from Indiana and I went out to Silicon Valley when I was 18 and I told everybody I didn't want to go to college. I was pretty clear on that. Like, I did not want to go to college. And since I had graduated from the Indiana Academy, which is a gifted and talented school. So Indiana has a really interesting program where they have a gifted and talented school that you go to for your last 2 years. And I know there's other states that have this too, because I've met people who've graduated from the Illinois version or whatnot. You actually live there in school, and it's on the Ball State University campus, and then you graduate with honors, and then you're automatically accepted as a graduate of that high school into any Indiana university, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people ended up going to IU or Purdue. So I was pretty clear that I didn't want to go to college, but I'm in this gifted and talented school. I'm in this program where it's pretty much college fast track.
You're locked in.
Yeah, and my teachers and my parents all flipped out about the fact that I didn't want to go. Both my parents have master's degrees, so they felt like their kids should be at least as educated as they were. And my teachers were so upset. I remember one of the computer science teachers, who was a woman, was extremely upset. She called me into her office and she said, "You're just throwing away this opportunity. You don't know how hard it was for me as a woman when I had to do this stuff in the 60s and 70s, and now here you are in the late 90s, and you've got all these opportunities in front of you, and you're just throwing them away." So I got a lot of that kind of stuff, but I was pretty clear. I just didn't want to go. So I ended up going to San Jose State, which is not a great school. No offense to the people who went to San Jose State, because I actually know a lot of really great people who graduated from there. But the first thing I noticed when I went there is that it was nobody's first choice of school. It's not that it's a bad school. It's just a state school and it's mostly commuter. And it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't anybody's first choice. I also got accepted into Santa Clara University, but I decided not to go because they wouldn't let freshmen pick their class times, I guess I should say. So you might have a class at 8 a.m. and a class at 8 o'clock at night in the same day. which made it impossible for me to work. And since this was 1999 and it was Silicon Valley, I wanted to go work for a .com.
How did you learn to code?
That's a great question. I actually took coding classes in school, but I could never focus and pay attention to them. I always thought I was the worst programmer in the world. I remember this. I took a C++ class in school and hated it because we were building things like math programs, you know, programs that would like add for you. And I was like, I have a calculator. Like, why do I need this?
This is not a problem I need to solve.
Yeah. But then when I was in high school in 96 and 97, I got access to the internet. So I think I've been on the internet since 94, 95.
And like the prodigy years.
Yeah, exactly. I was on AOL. And
back when it was cool.
Yeah, exactly. AOL was the coolest place to be. It's like Facebook of today. It really is. It's a very insular community of people who can chat with each other. And so I had AOL and dial-up. Then when I went to the academy, we actually had Ethernet connections. Very exciting. We had like a 10 megabit line, which was huge. And there was a T1 out of the building, so it was very fast for its time. So when I learned that you could build websites online, I thought, this is my thing. I'm going to build websites. And I actually ended up emailing all the web design firms in Cincinnati, Ohio, one summer between my junior and senior year. And I emailed 20 web design firms, and I showed them all the websites that I had built, and I asked for a job. I didn't mention that I was 16 at the time, 17. So I went to one interview with a firm. Actually, I got several interview requests. I went to one interview with a firm, and they laughed me out of the office as soon as they learned that I was a teenager. Well, the second firm hired me at minimum wage for an internship. And then they billed me out at $75 an hour writing Perl scripts for their clients.
I bet they did.
Very smart, those guys.
What made you do that? I mean, what made you as a 16-year-old email all of these firms and say, hey, I can build websites, let me work for you?
I didn't want a job doing fast food or restaurants or any of the typical teenager jobs because I had this thing that was really exciting. I could build websites, and it was a skill not many people had at the time, and I was really interested in just taking it to the next level. One of my motivations was to make money, but also because I was really passionate about this, and I just gave it a shot. It wasn't anything that my parents really encouraged me to do. I just kind of did it.
You were pretty clear about what you wanted,
yeah,
even from a young age, which is...
Yeah. Previous to that, I had worked at an SEO company, which wasn't called SEO back then. It was called Submitting to Search Engines, called WGI. They actually hired me to work from home. So I went on CareerBuilder, which was something back then. I don't know if it was called CareerBuilder. This was in like 1996, 97-ish. And I looked for work from home jobs, and my mom helped me kind of filter through some of the scams where they want you mm-hmm. to send them money. And I actually found a legit work from home job submitting sites to search engines. So they would send me a package of all their clients' information, like their name, their website, the title of the site, the what we would call today the meta description of the site, and, you know, meta keywords, and I would paste that into like 100 different search engines like InfoSeek and Lycos, and I'm sure there's gonna be some people listening to this who will go, yep, I remember that. And they had these packages where they would submit the sites to 100 search engines or 250, and then they would just pay you by the package. So it ended up, I got fast enough at copying and pasting that it made about $12.50 an hour. So,
which is good money when you're 14, 15.
Right. Yeah, and they gave you as much or as little work as you could handle during the week. They actually advertised by putting CD-ROM box software in computer stores, and then people would buy it. And then on the CD, you could submit it all yourself. And then most business owners, when they realized how much work that was like 4 hours of work to do it, they would just send it off to this company and pay them, I don't know how much, a couple $100 maybe, to submit the sites to search engines.
Were there any significant challenges or losses or big things that you had to work through as a kid?
As a kid, mostly it was the expectations of most people versus actually what I wanted to do. Because the expectations of most people were, and I'm just going to be honest here, like they were like, this kid is one of the smartest kids we've ever seen run through this school. When I was in first grade, they put me in a third grade reading class. They gave me a reading test when I was 6, and I was already reading at a college level.
Yeah.
And I had been reading since I was 3. And I got sent to a psychologist who like tested and showed that my IQ was like way the heck up there. But socially, I was almost underdeveloped. Because I was an only child, because I was adopted, because we didn't have a lot of neighborhood kids, because I was smarter than a lot of the other people, I had this really huge social awkwardness. And I really struggled to get along with other kids, especially kids my age. I just didn't have the same interests as kids my age. I don't know. I've read a lot about Asperger's maybe today. Like, as a kid, I would have been diagnosed with something like that, but I don't know. It was more of just not having those connections, not having brothers and sisters or any of those friend connections to really
take a lot of isolation.
Yeah,
probably
exactly.
In your head as well as in your life. You know, you were thinking about different things and your brain worked really differently than the other kids your age.
So I was well aware from a young age, this didn't help anything, that I was really different because I had been taken to psychologists because my reading skills were off the charts. And my math skills were pretty strong, too, but not as strong as my reading. When I was in kindergarten, actually, my mom put me through preschool another year with the preschool teacher because the preschool teacher actually understood how to work with gifted kids and kind of put me in a special class. So I knew when I was like 4 and 5 that I was really, really different from most kids.
Good different, but being different is still hard when you're a kid.
It's awkward, especially when you're growing up in a small town. And my mom had to petition the school to put me in the 3rd grade reading class when I was in 1st grade. And the principal literally didn't believe my mom that I could read like I could. And she brought in all the tests that she had done, and the principal still didn't believe it. So my mom dragged me in, and the principal gave me a book, and I read it. And the principal was just like, "We've never seen anything like this." Huh. I was well aware as a kid that I was pretty weird.
Awesome weird, but yeah. And how do you think that has shaped you as an entrepreneur?
I think knowing that I was weird from pretty much day one really made me unafraid to go out and do weird stuff that most people wouldn't do. I was not afraid in high school to say I don't want to go to college because I was pretty clear I didn't want to go to college. So I ended up going to college for 1.5 years and then dropping out. And I was not very interested in college for 1.5 years that I went there. College had never seemed like the right path for me, and I couldn't explain it to anybody.
So when you're 4 and 5 and you already have this sense of yourself that your life is not going to be like everyone's life around you, like you're not following the same script that other people are following.
No, I was in small town Indiana where most people were going to grow up and be in small town Indiana for the rest of their lives. And there's nothing wrong with that. Those people lead happy lives. I'm friends with many of them on Facebook and they're happy. But I knew it was never going to be for me. I knew that was never going to be who I was. And so I really struggled with the disconnect between where most of the kids were and where they were going to be and where I was and where the heck was I going to be. I knew I wasn't going to be in Indiana, but I didn't know where I was going to be. I figured I would just move to Silicon Valley when I was 18 and let stuff sort itself out.
Find some computer stuff to do.
Yeah.
And that sort of worked out.
Yeah.
So to shift gears a little bit, it's about 1 year ago that you wrote a blog post about basically your company imploding.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I reread part of it this morning, but it sounds like it was a really, really difficult time in your life.
It was. Well, think about now that you know about my childhood and my early childhood, and I've been kind of primed for success my whole life. Plus, I had 2 companies I had sold before that successfully. And to have one blow up in my face was really tough because I was one of those. There's those articles online about gifted kids and how when you tell them that they do everything right, then they don't want to try new stuff because they're scared that they won't be perfect at it.
Yes.
I have some of that for sure. So
you're willing to take risks, but it's because you really think that you're going to be successful.
True. Yeah. I'm not willing to take what I see as unreasonable risks. So I had one investor after my company failed, and he wrote me an email and he said, "I've always seen you as a bootstrapper at heart." And I think he was right. And I think I'm more along the lines of a bootstrapping business because it's a risk that I can control. And when you take investment, which is something I wrote about more recently on my blog, you have to show month over month, year over year, consistent, steady, strong growth in your company. And it's not to say I would never be able to start a company that does that, because I don't think that's true. It's because 99% of companies don't fit that profile. And the other 1%, you almost don't know when you start that they're going to be that business.
Sure.
Some people do, but most people don't realize until they've got it. They're sitting on the rocket ship and it's actually, whoa, it's blowing up in their faces. You know, it's going crazy. So that's when you look for VC funding. So for most of the types of businesses that I would start, bootstrapping would make more sense than VC funding.
So now that you're 1 year from the implosion, like, how are you recovering?
I would say, well, I took some time off. At first, I was kind of resistant to taking time off, and then I took a few weeks off, and then I took a couple months off, and then I was like, wow, I really needed this space to figure this stuff out and to figure out what I really wanted to do. And then I went into executive coaching for the rest of last year, which was actually a really great thing. So I worked with other entrepreneurs. It turned out all my coaching clients ended up being software company CEOs, which was really cool. Mm. So that kind of felt like where I was, and bootstrapped sort of people who were struggling with where to take their business next. And I really resonated with those kind of people. And I understood why you need coaching at that point. From a great coach who can really inspire you and move you forward.
I mean, it's interesting that you grew up in a place where you experienced a lot of isolation and loneliness. And then now as an adult, when you have your company fail, basically, you then begin to do something that's very interpersonal. It's very relational.
Yeah. Well, that's a challenge for me. I always like to pick the stuff that I know I'm not going to be good at, just as a way to challenge myself and to get through that whole perfectionism thing. Because probably the first few coaching calls I did weren't great. I kind of knew what I was doing, but not really. Then I did 30 of them and I got into my group.
And you got some practice.
And I realized that coaching is mostly just about being really present in the moment and seeing what that other person is going through and experiencing it with them. And then being able to use your own brain and skills and talents and perspective to be able to say, what if you did this? Or what if you looked at it this way? Yeah. That's really valuable.
Yeah. And there's no way you have Asperger's.
Yeah. I did have weird stuff as a kid. Like, I really liked pipes and toilets and, like, really, like, I loved plumbing and wiring and all that kind of weird stuff as a kid.
But. Yeah, but that also makes perfect sense because you love systems and how they fit together.
Yeah, I'm definitely a systems thinker. That's for sure. Yeah.
Is it an irritating question to be like, what's it like being a woman in software? I mean, are you over that question?
No, I'm happy to talk about it. I think it's hard. I think there are a lot of guys out there that don't understand how much small, pervasive sexism is in technology for women. And it's really hard to see it because it's so small. And then as a woman, when you blow up at something that's perceived by most people to be a small thing, people are like, whoa, that crazy woman, she blew up at stuff that's really small.
She's,
and you're like, yeah.
So emotional.
But, yeah. and then you're like, well, but there's been 100 of those things, and it's exasperating.
I think they call them microaggressions.
Yeah, microaggressions, yeah. Exactly. And I don't think most guys realize how pervasive it is. One thing I've noticed about every relationship I've been in with guys, every employee that I've had that has been really close to me as a guy, is that they realize how ridiculous and pervasive the sexism is. And they didn't realize it because they see me as a competent technical woman, and they assume naturally, because they're competent technical males, that I don't have any problems. And when they see it with their own eyes, I can remember my current boyfriend loves to make sexist jokes as jokes. Like, he's a troll, and it's fun, and I enjoy that side of him because he likes to be funny and
sort of that dark humor.
And when he got to be with me and he saw how people treated me, some guys, older guys in particular, like, we had a guy installing AT&T DSL at his retail store, and the AT&T guy just treated me like I didn't know anything, and I relayed the conversation to him. And he got so irritated and pounded his fist on the table, and he's like, this kind of crap should have been done with 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I could just tell that he was upset about it. And he was like, he told me the other day, he's like, you know, I just don't have it in me to make jokes like that anymore. Huh. He's like, I realize how hard it is for people like you. And he's like, it's so frustrating to me. He's like, you're so smart and you're so competent. And he's like, I don't know how anybody could perceive you any other way.
As less
people
than.
Do.
And not all of the aggressions have been microaggressions. Some of them have been...
Oh, some of them are outrageous.
Like, really scary aggressive.
Here's one from 2006 or 7. I was running my hosting company, and a guy asked if we could install his server on the weekend. So he bought a co-location package with an actual physical server and wanted me to come in on the weekend to help him install it. Usually I would say no to that kind of stuff, but he was really pushy about it. So I said, okay, fine. I'll come in on Saturday morning and help you install the server in the data center. It's fine, whatever. It's an hour out of my day. It's nothing to do. So I got up on Saturday morning, and my boyfriend came along with me. My boyfriend at the time just, why not, right? He's like, hey, I'll come with you, and then we'll go out and do something. We'll go out and have breakfast afterward. Great, cool. So we come in, and we're going up the elevator. I can remember this so clearly. We're going up to the elevator, and the guy with the server is talking only to my boyfriend the entire time. And my boyfriend, being the smart dude that he is, realizes what's going on. And he says, Eric is the CEO of the company. I actually don't work here. I just came along for the ride. And the guy continues to talk to only him. So my boyfriend uses a body language tactic to maneuver his gaze over to me. And so he stops talking to the guy, but he just looks at me every time the guy says something. And the guy continues to only talk to him. And we install the guy's server. You know, we get out of there like an hour later, and my boyfriend is so pissed. He's like, what is up with that guy? And I'm like, welcome to being a woman in technology. And he was like, and I hear this over and over again, like I said, from every guy I've ever worked with or dated. And they're just like, why do people do that? And it's so frustrating for them, because he said, I told him several times, you're the CEO of the company. I don't even work here. I work for another company. Like, I don't have anything to do with any of this. And the guy continues to talk to only me. Yep.
How do you take care of your own self, you know, like your own heart and your own head when, I mean, I think there is this extra layer that you have to do. Not only do you have to do the actual work and the brain stuff that goes into running companies and supporting CEOs and all the things that you do, but you have to kind of wear this extra layer of protection.
It's really hard. I was in Techstars with my last company, and I got pulled aside by the managing director of the program, and he was telling me that the mentors, some of the mentors felt that you were a little aggressive, Erica. And I said, do you understand that aggressive is a catchphrase that they use when they are uncomfortable with how a woman is interacting with them? I tend to be very blunt. I tend to be very self-assured. And those are two things that most women aren't. And it's very difficult for some men in particular to deal with that sort of person.
And there are traits that are celebrated in men.
Of course, right? So I sent Jason Seitz, the managing director, I sent him some articles about the word aggressive and why that is used in a derogatory way toward women. But in men, again, it's considered a celebrated trait. And he wrote me back and he said, okay, you've opened my eyes. I didn't know that this was going on. I'm going to go give this some feedback. So I went to one of the female mentors and I explained that. And she said, yeah, they told me that too. Ugh, really frustrating. And so I said, well, I said, I've already sent Jason the information on how aggressive is a trigger word for technical women who are blunt or confident.
Smart and confident and self-assured. Aggressive.
I said, but how can I change my interactions? And she said, you know, there's this really fine line between aggressive and passive, and you just have to be there. And she showed me some speech patterns that I could change. It's so frustrating. Yeah. Men don't have to think about which speech patterns they need to change in order to not be perceived as aggressive, which is not considered negative for them. So it continues to this day, and I've just kind of pushed through it. Like, that's really the only thing that I can do. I have to stay in the industry. I don't feel obligated to stay in the industry, but I feel strongly that I should, because there's so few of us here. So
it's an industry that you love, but
yeah,
you're changing it from the inside out.
I've loved it my whole life. And ever since the internet's been around, I've been like, this is what I want to do. I want to build websites. I want to be on the internet. And that's been my whole life. And so the only thing I can do is to be a role model to younger women. I'm in a Facebook group called Hackathon Hackers, which is mostly women who are college age. And recently a couple of really sexist things have blown up in that group. And I was just devastated. I was like, here is another generation of women going through the same stupid thing that I had to go through for the past 10 or 15 years. And some part of me had hoped that this generation was going to be better, that it was not going to be as sexist as the last one. And maybe it gets a little bit better with every generation. I don't know.
I think change is really slow in coming.
Yeah, but to watch that blow up amongst college kids, 19 and 20-year-old women, and them throwing a fit and saying, this is why women drop out of computer science programs. This is why we have fewer women in computer science than we did 20 years ago, which is true, which is crazy. And to watch that whole thing wash through another generation of women was just like, ugh, I really hope that we would get through this.
Yeah. Depressing.
Yeah. A little bit. I try not to let myself get too down about it.
Yeah. Kind of keep busy, keep fighting.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
So what's next for me? I'm launching a program called, the tentative title is called Freedom Seekers. I think I'm going to launch with that title and we'll see where it goes from there. So it's a month-long program designed to help people who have a website and they're making a little bit of money online. Maybe they're coaches, consultants, info product marketers, bloggers, but they want to take it to the next level. I'm clearly marketing it as a not how to make your first dollar online program because there are a couple friends of mine who actually run those kinds of programs. They're really good at what they do. So it's not how to make your first dollar online. It's I made $200 and I want to turn this into an actual full-time income. Or, you know, I've had a couple of clients find me through my website, but I really want this to be a steady stream of clients finding me through my site. How do I get from I've set it up and made my first few dollars to I'm turning this into a full-time income. So that's what I'm designing Freedom Seekers to be.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That and continuing to lend your voice to the tech world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to continue to blog because I think that's one of the more important parts of the whole thing to see week by week or month by month how you set up a business, how you make money. I had set a goal at the beginning of this year to write a blog post every week, which I haven't been 100% consistent with, I'll be honest, because I've been working in my boyfriend's retail store and helping him source products from China. And
because you're doing other things.
Yeah.
Like, life is full.
Working 60 hours a week, and it's great because working 60 hours a week means he has plenty of clients in the store. So that's the important part. But he just hired his first full-time employee. So as of last week, now I'm able to bring my almost full-time focus, probably 30 hours a week, into this new program.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, so that's what I decided to do, and I'll launch it, and we'll see how it goes.
Cool.
And if it stinks, then I'll launch something else.
Plan B.
Well, that's the fun part about launching. I always hear people say, I heard this guy yesterday here at MicroConf, and he said, well, I'm afraid that if I launch, I'll get too many clients. And I've heard that before. It happens. People get scared of that sort of stuff. So I said to him, it's not about too many clients. It's about getting the first five clients. And here's what you do. You say, I'm only going to accept five clients. So for Freedom Seekers, I thought about setting it about 15. So I'm only going to accept 15 people. I don't want to be overwhelmed. I have 21,000 people on my email list. Maybe 100 people will apply. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe two people will apply. Who knows? But I don't want to have 500 people go through the course right away. So this enables me to just say, hey, I'm just going to work with 15 people straight up.
The concept, get good at it.
No more than that. And I told him, just work with five people and say that publicly. I'm only going to work with five people right now. I'm only going to work with two people right now. He said, oh. So.
Well, it's that. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
Very interesting conversation.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder.
We'll be back next week with another conversation about how to enjoy a little bit more Zen in your startup life.